The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we thank them for their support. Making the Nation. Today's craft renaissance is more than just an antidote to our over-automated world. It renews a way of life that made us who we are. By Glenn Adamson. It has never been easy to be an artisan in America. That was true when the United States was a new nation, and it is true today. In some ways, the challenges have not even changed that much. Yes, we seem to live our lives on permanent fast forward these days, with boundless opportunities for immediate gratification and distraction. Information and resources are more accessible than ever before. What used to be mysteries of the trade are now floating out there on YouTube. The most specialized tools and materials can be ordered for next-day delivery. Yet, it still takes long years to achieve mastery in a craft. The difficulty of getting wood, leather, clay, fabric, stone, or glass to do what you want remains the same. And the business side of earning a livelihood with your hands, day in and day out, is as demanding as ever. These challenges, which all makers hold in common, can be great equalizers, giving craft the potential to cut across social divides and provide a powerful sense of continuity with the past. This possibility has never seemed more within our reach, for the United States is currently experiencing a craft renaissance, arguably the most momentous in our history. Not even the arts and crafts movement, which ended about a century ago, achieved the scale of today's artisan economy, or anything like its diversity. This is big news, and it is good news, but it's not necessarily simple. To better understand this great resurgence of craft, I interviewed contemporary makers about their experiences of learning, setting up shop, developing a name for themselves, working with clientele, and finally, passing skills on to others. Having recently completed a book on the history of American craft, I have been fascinated that many stories from the past find continuity with today. All across the country, craftspeople are prevailing over the challenges that invariably come their way, and long-standing traditions are being extended and transformed. Take, for example, Virgil Ortez. He began his career as a potter, drawing on the deep cultural well of Cochiti Pueblo in New Mexico, where he was born and raised. While ceramics remain central for him, he works in other disciplines as well, film, fashion, jewelry, and more. He picked up skills one after another in what he describes as an organic process of development. If I did not live close to an exhibition venue, I needed slides to present my work. So that led to photography. Then came magazine ads, so I taught myself graphic design. If I wanted a leather coat I had seen in a fashion magazine and could not possibly afford it, I taught myself how to sew. Each medium inspires another. It's never ending. Ortez's work is equally far-reaching in its content. For many years, he has been creating imagery based on the Pueblo Revolt, a successful uprising of indigenous people against the Spanish that occurred in 1680. Most people in the U.S. have never heard of this First American Revolution, as Ortez calls it, and he has set himself the task of elevating awareness of it. He tells the story in a complex and highly imaginative way, interweaving elements from a parallel science fiction narrative set in the year 2180 in an effort to reach younger audiences. His pots and figural sculptures are populated by his own invented characters, yet at the same time keep the tradition of Cochiti clay alive, a sophisticated mixture of past, present, and future. Unlike other Americans today, Ortez was surrounded by craft as a child. He was born into a family of potters on his mother's side, and his father was a drum maker. We were always surrounded by art, traditional ceremonies, and dances, he says. I didn't realize that art was being created daily in our household until I was about 11 years old. But I can definitely say that we had the best possible professors to teach us about traditional work. When he was still young, Ortez learned how to dig clay from the ground, process paint from plants, and fire pottery in an open pit using cow manure, aspen, and cedar for fuel. Having learned to use these methods and materials, he says, made every other medium seem a whole lot easier. It is tempting to imagine that back in the day, all artisans had experiences like Ortez's and came easily to their trade. In fact, the picture is far more complicated. Certainly, there was a general high level of material intelligence in the population. People understood how textiles were woven, furniture was built, and metal was forged. Yet attaining a professional craft skill was not a straightforward proposition. Pardon me for the rattling pages. The overall competency and self-sufficiency of Native Americans was regarded with considerable awe by white colonists, who generally lacked such capabilities. Guilds on the strict European model were non-existent. In a young country defined by mobility, it was nearly impossible to impose consistent standards or even keep artisans on the job. Young men were known to flee their indentures and apprenticeships before their terms were over in order to set up their own shop and start earning, the most famous example being Benjamin Franklin, who went on to become a secular saint, the ultimate self-made man. Yet this stereotype of the craftsperson as an upwardly mobile, native-born white man is misleading. The majority of craftspeople throughout American history were immigrants, women, and ethnic minorities. All faced prejudice and economic hardship. Immigrant artisans often came with superior skills because of their traditional training, but they tended to arouse suspicion and hostility among native-born workers, often to the point of violence. Women, half the population of the skilled makers, were all but shut out of professional trades until the late 20th century. They had to practice their crafts informally at home, or while playing a supportive role in the family shop. Widows were an important exception. They became prominent in trades like printing and cabinet making, which were otherwise male-dominated. Betsy Ross probably did not design the Stars and Stripes as legend has it, but she did run an upholstery business for more than 50 years following the death of her first husband, a great achievement in a society that little rewarded women's enterprise. The craftspeople who have contended with the greatest obstacles have been Native Americans and African Americans. The indigenous experience of displacement is a tragedy. Just one of the consequences was disruption to long-established ways of making. It has required a tremendous force of cultural will on the part of generations of Native people like Virgil Ortez, to maintain and rebuild those bonds of culture. The brutal realities of enslavement and racism made the stories of black craftsmen especially fraught and painful, all the more so because, in spite of what they faced, African-American artisans literally built this country. The extent of their contribution is being gradually revealed through, again, apologize for the rattling, through archival research. Tiffany Momon, founder of the Black Craftspeople Digital Archive, has been a leading voice in this work. She and her colleagues combed through historical documents looking for records of African-American artisans and telling their stories. I asked her to explain what craft meant for black Americans in the 19th century. Practicing a skilled trade provided enslaved craftspeople with some advantages, she told me, including the ability to, in some circumstances, earn wages and purchase themselves or their family members. The potential ability to buy oneself was undoubtedly a motivating factor for enslaved craftspeople to pursue and perfect their work. With the end of the Civil War, emancipation, and Reconstruction, you find that many formerly enslaved craftspeople, that is, continued to practice their trades as freed people, enabling them to leave plantations for urban areas. They avoided the fate of many who ended up in exploitative sharecropping agreements with former enslavers. Some of the most moving testimonies to black artisans' lives are those they recorded themselves. The ceramic artist David Drake, often called Dave the Potter, who was born into slavery in Edgefield, South Carolina, inscribed his impressive large storage vessels with poetic verses. One heartbreaking couplet seemed to speak to enforced separation from his own family members, yet concludes a gesture of universal goodwill. I wonder where all my relations, friendship to all and every nation. The seamstress Elizabeth Keckley, who was born into slavery in Dinwiddie, Virginia, wrote in her autobiography, I came upon the earth free and godlike, thought, but fettered in action. She managed to become a much sought-after dressmaker in Washington, D.C., and a confidant of Mary Todd Lincoln in the Civil War White House. As a young man, Frederick Douglass was an enslaved ship's caulker in Baltimore. He had terrible experiences during those years, but the future orator also drew deeply upon them in his later writings and spoke of artisan pride and opportunity. Give him fair play and let him be, Douglass wrote of the black artisan. Throw open to him the doors of the schools, the factories, the workshops, and of all mechanical industries. Give him all the facilities for honest and successful livelihood, and in all honorable avocations receive him as a man among men. In the years following the Civil War, the educator Booker T. Washington led a nationwide effort to provide young African Americans with craft-based training, which he described as a means of uplift. The Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, which he founded, and the racially integrated Barrow College in Kentucky offered craft-based education for boys and girls, though it was strictly separated by gender, carpentry and blacksmithing versus sewing and cookery. But these efforts never adequately addressed the needs of black students. The courses were often poor in quality, separate and unequal, with behind-the-times equipment, problems exacerbated with the rise of Jim Crow, leading to the segregation of schools like Berea. By the time of the Great Depression, as Carter G. Woodson explained in his 1933 book, The Miseducation of the Negro, African-American craftspeople still lacked equal access to training and employment. educators today continue the struggle against inequity. There is some cause for optimism. Federal funding for career and technical education is a rare policy for which there has been genuine bipartisan support over the past few years. And the introduction of digital tools such as design, software, and 3D printers brings forward-facing legitimacy to such classes. Above all, though, are the efforts of individual educators. Clayton Evans is a teacher at McClymans High School in Oakland. He was born in 1993, after the death of trades, as he puts it, and hardly any experience of making things by hand when he was growing up. After studying science and engineering in college, though, he came to see teaching as political work. Evans could be paraphrasing Douglass when he says he wants his students to feed themselves and their families with what they are learning. He first went to McClymans to teach physics and immediately became curious about the old wood and metal shop. It was locked up and used by the janitorial staff to store unwanted white items. But after getting inside the space, Evans realized it had good bones. The shop was wired with industrial voltage and had a stock of well-built old machines. He set to work, clearing out the junk, teaching himself to repair and operate the equipment. Before long, he was instructing about 100 kids each year. Evans teaches old and new techniques, woodwork and metalwork, engineering fundamentals, digital design. He encourages students to break out of a consumer mentality and actually solve problems. When his school managed to acquire a set of 3D printers, he didn't teach the students how to make cute little objects out of extruded plastic, as is fairly common in maker spaces across the country. Instead, he showed them how to disassemble the machines, then rebuild and customize them. This path to self-reliance is connected to one of Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington had in mind. The difference, perhaps, is that Evans rejects the cliché of the self-made American. Excuse me. As he points out, it is literally impossible to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Remember, he's a physics teacher. The educational system must shift away from a generic one-size-fits-all curriculum, he says, and instead provide tailored pathways to employment. Excuse me. And more than that, I certainly want my students to have trade skills and knowledge to hustle, Evans says. But their mindsets are even more important to me. If we want freedom, we need to build lives beyond pathways to employment. Hopefully, students' time in my shop will help them build and sustain their communities in new, socially just economies. John Levine, another CTE educator who works at Westmore High School in Daly City, California, runs a program teaching traditional skills, like woodworking, alongside new digital techniques, such as laser engraving and robotics. His students are primarily of Latino, Arab, Filipino background, from immigrant working class families. They are sometimes able to get well-paid jobs right out of school or start their own businesses. If they attend college, they are likely to be the first in their families to do so. Levine aims for such positive outcomes for his students, but it is by no means a certainty for every one of them. All he can do, he says, is inspire and train and help them see a way forward. The same ethos animates craft at the college level, among other places at Berea, where the craft workshops are still in operation. Today, the college has one of the most diverse student bodies in the nation, with all students attending tuition-free. As part of a long-standing institutional commitment made possible in part by the college endowment, The workshop program has shifted to reflect this new reality. Last year, Berea College student Kraft invited Stephen Burks, a pioneering African-American industrial designer based in New York City, to collaborate on the development of a new product line under the title Crafting Diversity. Burks has preserved the college's traditional strengths, such as broom making and basket weaving, while introducing bold new forms, patterns, and colors. A broad palette representing different perspectives. Students in the program have been encouraged to contribute their own design ideas to the project. And Burks has also devised clever ways for each object to be customized by the students, not just learning and solving problems as they work, but also infusing the results with their own personal creativity. The goal is not just to expand the symbolism of this craft, of this storied craft program, but also to propel students into lifelong involvement with craft and design. This is one artisanal history that is being reimagined to suit present day. Where I feel kinship with craftspeople before me is the transformation of tragic circumstances to make something from it. These are the words of Johannes Joseph LaCour, a Chicago leather artist who is not just a skilled designer and maker, but also a successful entrepreneur. Like so many black artisans in the past, he worked hard to get where he is today. LaCour spent 9 years of his life in a federal prison in Duluth, Montana, 8 of them making leather work. The craft became simply as a mental escape, but it soon became a passion to create something from nothing, he says. Initially, he learned skills from other inmates, some of whom had moved from one jail to another for decades, picking up techniques on the way. Soon it was the other way around. He was inventing his own methods and teaching them to others. LaCour has been out of prison for about 3 years and has devoted that time to building his own brand. JYL, making handbags and sneakers. His work reflects his prison experience. In those days, he often had to work with scraps and develop an innovative style of collage construction. But his inspiration is primarily from the hip-hop scene that he knew growing up, with its emphasis on improvisation and reinvention. He is constantly developing new shapes, making leather do things I haven't seen leather do before, he said. His viewpoint is unique. I page through the fashion magazines looking for things I don't see, bringing it back home to the streets and taking what I know from the streets aesthetically and cosmically. LaCour's business is growing so quickly that he is exploring the possibility of engaging a manufacturer to execute some of his designs. LaCour is keenly aware of the broader implications of these choices and of his place in the long lineage of black American luxury tradesmen, running back through the pioneer of 1880s hip-hop fashion. Dapper Dan to the cobblers and seamstresses of the 19th century. He is aware, too, that his life experience reflects a tragic side of African-American history, that the contemporary prison system replicates past oppression. LaCour cites Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, as an important influence. He has avoided outside investment. Sole ownership represents a truer freedom for black people, he says. Until we have our own, we will forever be in a dependent state. I heard something similar from Margaret Wheeler. She is founder of Mahota Textiles, based in Oklahoma, the first textile company in the nation owned by a Native American tribe. She shares LaCour's perception about the intertwining of craft and self-determination. Wheeler, now 77 years old, is of Chickasaw heritage. Like Virgil Ortiz, she grew up in a house filled with crafts. Her mother and grandmother were constantly crocheting, knitting, and embroidering, and she took up these skills early in life. For years, she did not think of fibers as her true creative work. But arriving at Pittsburgh State University in Kansas in the late 1970s, she encountered some great teachers, including the experimental jeweler Marjorie Schick, who exposed her to the possibilities of metalwork and weaving as expressive disciplines. Wheeler benefited from the surprisingly robust craft infrastructure of the American university system. In the days after World War II, courses in weaving, ceramics, and metalwork were widely available in higher education, mainly to accommodate returning soldiers seeking degrees through the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, popularly known as the GI Bill. That federal support went almost entirely to white men. They made up the majority of the armed forces, and the black and Native American soldiers who did serve often did not receive the benefits they were due. Ira Katzelson tells the story in his pointedly titled book, When Affirmative Action Was White. Figures like Charles LaLoma, a celebrated hobby potter and jeweler who attended the School for American Craftsmen on the GI Bill, were the exception. It was not until the 1970s, in the wake of the Civil Rights era and contemporaneous Red Power movement, that craft courses in American universities started to become more ethnically inclusive. After completing her degree, Wheeler became a teacher, and then, in 1984, took up weaving full-time. She showed her work at Native-oriented museums in the Southwest and presented her work at Indian markets and in fashion shows. She also has experience as a designer for the theater, on one occasion creating the costumes for an all-Chickasaw musical production. Despite her success, it was only thanks to her entrepreneurial spirit and financial backing of her tribe that Wheeler was able to set up Mahota. The company, which specializes in blankets and also makes bags and pillows, is named for her great-great-great-grandmother, who suffered forced removal. And that, my friends, wraps up our reading for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for that support. This content is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. So long until next time. Call us at 919-832-5138 if you have any questions. And this reading will be saved as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Hope you have a good day.